This is Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. We present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus said to his apostles, "Do not let anyone intimidate you. Nothing is concealed that will not be revealed, and nothing hidden that will not become known. What I tell you in darkness, speak in the light. What you hear in private, proclaim from the housetops. Do not fear those who deprive the body of life, but cannot destroy the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna. Are not two sparrows sold for next to nothing? Yet not a single sparrow falls to the ground without your Father's consent. As for you, every hair of your head has been counted. So do not be afraid of anything. You are worth more than an entire flock of sparrows. Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father in heaven. Whoever disowns me before men, I will disown before my Father in heaven."
The words spoken to the apostles here are clearly considered of enormous importance, not only by Matthew, but also by Luke and Mark. All three declare, in one way or another, that there is nothing hidden which will not be uncovered. Both Mark and Luke say it after the parable of the lamp.
"No one lights a lamp to cover it with a bowl or to put it under a bed. No, he puts it on a lampstand so that people may see the light when they come in. For nothing is hidden, but it will be made clear. Nothing secret, but it will be known and brought to light."
Thus Luke, and Mark likewise. Luke, moreover, repeats the same concept when recording our Lord's instructions to the apostles in very similar words to those of Matthew in our Gospel today. He also sets the scene in his inimitable style.
"Meanwhile, the people had gathered in their thousands so that they were treading on one another, and he began to speak, first of all, to his disciples."
And after warning them to beware of the Pharisees and their hypocrisy, Luke paraphrases Matthew's words with a difference. Where Matthew says, "What I tell you in darkness, speak in the light. What you hear in private, proclaim from the housetops," Luke writes, "Whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you have whispered in hidden places will be proclaimed on the housetops." If we, as broadcasters, were to choose one version rather than the other, it will surely be Matthew's, as Pope Paul VI himself chose in his address for the 40th anniversary of Vatican Radio in 1971.
"No instrument has taken on such importance and such dignity today as the radio, in the service of the announcement of divine truth and of Christian salvation. Here, perhaps, Jesus' own words suit our purpose perfectly. What I say to you in the dark, tell in the daylight. What you hear in whispers, proclaim from the housetops."
In the Jerusalem Bible translation of both Luke and Matthew's account, the passage is preceded by the title, "Open and Fearless Speech." And this seems to be the key to understanding or interpreting these words of our Lord. A courageous witness to the truth, in short. Jesus has warned the apostles already that they will suffer persecution. "But they are not to be afraid," he tells them, "not of those who kill the body." In today's version, we are given the somewhat euphemistic phrase, "who deprive the body of life," but "who cannot kill the soul," or "destroy the soul." Luke doesn't use the phrase, "who cannot kill the soul." He writes,
"To my friends I say, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that can do no more."
"Only him who can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna are they to fear," we read in today's version. The other versions all use the word hell. Matthew doesn't linger on the subject of hell, but Luke is very emphatic in his warning.
I will tell you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him.
The Hebrew word Gehenna has long been synonymous with the place of eternal torment. Strictly speaking, it means the valley of Ben-Hinnom, Gehinnom, a place near Jerusalem where sacrifices to Baal and Moloch were offered. Because of this, Yahweh said to Jeremiah, people will call it Valley of Slaughter. It came to be regarded as a place of unquenchable fire, possibly, we're told, because of the fires of Moloch. It's interesting to see that in two recent dictionaries, while both give the origin of the name, one then defines it as hell in capital letters, the other simply says, in small letters, a name for hell. And now our Lord brings into this serious discourse, as he does so often, a reference to the natural world, to those creatures so common and so familiar as to be almost discounted, but not by the God who made them.
Are not two sparrows sold for next to nothing? Yet not a single sparrow falls to the ground without your father's consent.
Towards the end of the play Hamlet, Shakespeare has Hamlet say to his friend Horatio, there's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. In our time, the sparrow, together with a number of other species of birds, has suffered a decline. But in the time of our Lord, they were probably as numerous as they were 50 years ago. In my illustrated gospel, there's a colour photograph of two Palestinian sparrows sitting on a boulder on the shore of Lake Tiberias. If sparrows were sold, what were they used for? Did people keep them in cages as pets? The Roman poet Catullus, who lived in the century before Christ, urges all men of taste to come and mourn a sparrow.
My lady sparrow, oh, he's sped. The bird my lady loved is dead.
But until recently, the sparrow doesn't seem to have had a very good press, even among declared bird lovers. Except in town, we'd rather be without them, wrote Edward Gray bluntly in The Charm of Birds. And in a guide to bird watching, Bruce Campbell admitted,
the house sparrow is one of the mixed blessings of civilization. It has spread, with man's help, almost all over the world, and in North America it's numbered in millions. Although to us it is the town bird, the sparrow is, speaking generally, a bird of cornland. Even in Britain, the breeding colonies on buildings tend to be deserted daily in July, for the fields of ripening grain in the surrounding countryside. And it was probably because we feed domestic animals on corn that it first came into the towns.
In A Book of Common Birds, Edmund Sanders has this to say of sparrows.
They will always be near your home, or wherever corn is stored, or wherever grain is scattered to hens. Where there are no men, there are no sparrows, for they depend on getting much of their food at our expense. They do much harm in eating our corn, but they help us by eating insects on which they also feed their young. I've seen a cock sparrow in a London parking place who'd found out that motors often had dead insects caught in their radiators, and he was flying up to pick them out when the cars stopped.
Let's Watch the Birds is the enthusiastic title of a book by Percival Westall, but in writing of the house sparrow, he complains.
Found in almost every haunt one could mention, as a garden bird, it's a great nuisance. It has a nasty habit of picking off my yellow crocuses, pink and yellow primroses, polyanthuses and other flowers, and this apparently for sheer mischief. Then, too, it dusts itself in fine soil where seeds have been sown and dislodges them, if it does not devour them. It is true that the house sparrow feeds on greenfly, on the fruit and rose trees, but its bad deeds, I'm afraid, far outnumber the good. It stuffs up eaves and water pipes with its bulky, untidy nest.
And so the chorus of complaints goes on, writes Gray.
Sparrows will chirp in the early morning in such a manner as to be a nuisance while other birds are singing. Their very chirp is harsh amongst other chirps. To song, it's an offence.
There was even a play which I saw in the late 1950s called, with Cockney humour, Sparrows Can't Sing. But in this poem by Humbert Wolfe, they have something to say on the matter.
Two sparrows feeding heard a thrush sing to the dawn. The first said, "Tush! In all my life I have never heard a more affected singing bird." The second said, "It's you and me who slave to keep the likes of he." "And if we cared," both sparrows said, "we'd do that singing on our head." The thrush pecked sideways and was dumb. "And now," they screamed, "he's pinched our crumb."
Certainly, as Geoffrey Young comments in The Country Year,
"The sparrow makes a fair din at all times of the year with chirruping calls but no real song, possibly noisiest in spring when, after making the nest, the cock sparrow advertises it by chirping ceaselessly from close by."
But there is, nevertheless, something to be said for this much denigrated bird. And for some people, the sparrow is not to be dismissed lightly. A modern guide points out,
"There can be few more familiar birds than the boisterous, cheeky house sparrow. Much regarded as a small brown bird, it's actually quite intricately coloured."
And writing in the magazine Birds, Sasha Norris agrees and reports her experience.
"The first time I held a sparrow in my hand, I was astounded by the intricacy of its plumage, the delicate lacing of colours, and layers of minute feathers on this least celebrated bird. I started feeding the sparrows in my garden and put some colour rings on them so I could identify individuals. One male sparrow returned 4 years in a row to nest under the gutter outside my bedroom window. This connection revealed something that is too easy to overlook, that individual animals have individual lives just like us, that they suffer trauma and enjoy triumph and change throughout their lives."
This last comment brings us closer to what Jesus seems to have had in mind, our oneness with the rest of creation, and what Pope John Paul said in his encyclical on social concern, that we must respect the beings which constitute the natural world, and that we must acquire
a growing awareness of the fact that one cannot use with impunity the different categories of beings, whether living or inanimate, animals, plants, the natural elements, simply as one wishes, according to one's own economic needs. On the contrary, one must take into account the nature of each being and of its mutual connection in an ordered system, which is precisely the cosmos.
In his classic book, Walden, or Life in the Woods, the 19th-century American essayist and poet Henry David Thoreau wrote,
"I once had a sparrow alight upon my shoulder for a moment while I was hoeing in a village garden, and I felt that I was more distinguished by that circumstance than I should have been by any epaulette I could have worn."
Words for reflection. And long, long ago, in his ecclesiastical history, Bede the Venerable reported the words of one of the chief counsellors of King Edwin of Northumbria. Bede completed his history in the year 731, but the episode he recounts took place in 627. Paulinus of York was chaplain to Edwin's wife, Ethelberga, and instructed Edwin in the faith. But before he committed himself, the king wanted to hear the opinions of his closest advisers. This is what one of them said, addressing the king.
Your Majesty, when we compare the present life of man with that time of which we have no knowledge, it seems to me like the swift flight of a lone sparrow through the banqueting hall, where you sit in the winter months to dine with your thanes and counselors. Inside, there's a comforting fire to warm the room. Outside, the wintry storms of snow and rain are raging. This sparrow flies swiftly in through one door of the hall and out through another. While he's inside, he's safe from the winter storms. But after a few moments of comfort, he vanishes from sight into the darkness whence he came. Similarly, man appears on earth for a little while, but we know nothing of what went before this life and what follows. Therefore, if this new teaching can reveal any more certain knowledge, it seems only right that we should follow it.